six of the graphics papers that were submitted, the SIGGRAPH, so this one's not going on the web because obviously these papers are only submitted and they're not actually the ones. Graphics is this kind of weird field because we have one major conference per year, so we all sort of kill ourselves December and January to do these submissions. So that's what you're going to see. And so we have six speakers. Everybody's going to aim for being just under 10 minutes so we can take a couple of questions on each paper.
So hi, my name is Alla Safonu, and I'll be talking about construction optimal search of interpolated motion graph. This is our SIGGRAPH submission, and this is a joint work with Jessica Hacking. So sir, current commercial systems, such as one shown in this picture, Maya, mostly target professional users. So if you take this character, you can create a very detailed and nice motion of this character, but you need to program all the control of this character at any point in time. And to be able to do it, you actually have to, first of all, have quite a bit of talent, and also you need a lot of training. So the goal of our work is to actually make animation accessible to naive, unexperienced users. So to be able to do it, we only want users to provide a very rough sketch of the motion of the character, and then our system should synthesize motion that matches that sketch, but at the same time, it should be physically correct, natural looking, and satisfy all the other like environmental constraints. So the only thing the user specifies in this example is that a sketch and the fact that she needs to sit in a chair. So to solve a problem when you're given so little information, the common way to solve this problem is to set up optimization problem. So we need to define unknowns, and unknowns in our case are poses of this character over time. So as she moves through this motion, we need to compute the pose of this character at every point in time, and poses defined by 60 degrees of freedom, which include all the joint angles of the character and the root position and orientation of the character. So we also need to define objective functions. So in our case, we are trying to compute an energy efficient motion, so we are minimizing sum of square torque, which is a very common objective function. And the constraint include user constraint, which is a sketch in this case, and the fact that she needs to sit in a chair. And the environmental constraint, which is the fact that she needs to walk over this beam and jump across those holes and go under the bar. And also, we'd like the physics of the motion to be as close as possible to correct. So because you need to find the 60 unknowns at every point in time, this problem is really hard to solve. So it's a really large search space, and it's very hard to solve. So in this example, we're trying to optimize in this space, and the user specified the start and end poses of the jump. And usually you end up in some bad local minima, so you don't get a very good solution. So I'll just play it one more time. So again, you're given start and end poses, this is why they look good, but everything in between is quite unnatural. So the point of this motion is just to show that while looking for solution, optimizer examined a large percentage of poses and large percentage of velocities which are natural. So it searches this huge space which contains a lot of those unnatural poses. And that leads to the key idea behind our work. We want to build a compact representation of human motion, and we can build it based on available human motion capture database. So there is a motion capture lab and a wind hall, and we captured large variety of human motion, like all possible behaviors, running, walking, jumping, many different behaviors. It's about 6 hours of motion capture. And based on this motion capture, we can build this compact space, and then we restrict the optimizer to only search this much smaller space, and the search becomes much more effective. And also we get natural-looking motion because optimizer is biased toward this natural-looking solution because it only searches this space. And our compact representation is called interpolated motion graphs, and that's what I will talk about next. So it involves two techniques, interpolation and motion graph. So interpolation is a very common technique in graphics, and motion interpolation was introduced to graphics community in 1995. So what you do, you take two motions which are similarly structured, and in this case she's walking over the brick, and you interpolate them to create any of the intermediate motions. So the two motions on the left are motion capture, and this one is interpolated motion. And you can do the same for different behaviors. So here's two motion capture sequences of a jump, and you can interpolate and synthesize anything in between. So results, the interpolation usually produces surprisingly natural results. And we noticed it, and we actually analyzed interpolated motion for physical correctness, and we showed that in many cases, interpolation produces motions which are close to physical correct. And that makes interpolation actually a very good candidate for us to create this space. So the problem is that you're restricted to those short motion segments which are similarly structured, like she has to start walking from the same leg and so on. So what we do, we actually allow interpolations of paths through the motion graph. So rather than interpolating those short motion segments, we interpolate paths through the motion graph. And so what is a motion graph? So you capture raw data of the character doing different behaviors, just you capture for some time. So in this case, you're capturing walking behavior, the character just moving. In this case, it's four characters. And then after you capture this data, you just build a graph. And each node in this graph corresponds to a pose of the character. And the transitions are just points where motions are similar, so you can transition from one motion to another. So once you build this graph, you can just traverse this graph and generate a variety of different motions. So here's work of Jay Healy that was done while he was here actually at CMU. So you can just drive this character through this environment by just traversing the motion graph. So the problem with motion graph is that you can obviously restrict it to whatever data you have in this graph, and you cannot synthesize variations of the motions besides whatever is inside this graph. So what we show that we can construct actually interpolated motion graph, and each path through the interpolated motion graph represents interpolation of two paths through original motion graph, and that allows us to represent a much wider variety of behaviors. But at the same time, it's a compact representation of the motion because you are restricted to interpolation of paths through the motion graph, so you can't just take any possible poses. So we show how to construct this graph, but this graph is still quite large, and we'd like to search it for an optimal solution. So we also show how to actually compress this graph to a graph which is much smaller, but functionally equivalent to the original graph. And we get a very good compression ratio. So number of states and number of transitions gets much smaller. And finally, we show that we can actually search this graph for an optimal solution. And this example just illustrates why it's actually important to find an optimal solution. So we want to go from this square and touch this square. The character should go from this square and touch this square. And this is the first solution we find if you just search this graph. It's a greedy solution because you're just trying to reach as quickly as possible. And so this is obviously not a natural solution. You can actually hurt your back if you do something like this in real life. So this is a better solution, but still a little bit awkward. But if you find an optimal solution, the motion patterns are much more natural. And here's another example. You have motion graph with blocks of different step length. And this is the first solution you find, and it's not a very natural and efficient pattern of walk. But if you actually search for an optimal solution, you find this much more efficient walking pattern. Another advantage you get, like usually you have a motion graph that has many, many different behaviors, and you need to figure out when to transition between the behaviors. So in this case, she needs to go from the first circle to the second circle. And if you just find the solution through the graph, it may look like this. So she does get from the first circle to the second, but the motion doesn't look realistic. But if you find an optimal solution, it automatically figures out when to transition from the walking motion to the ducking motion. So this example just illustrates the benefit of interpolation. We want you to go through this first circle and touch a whole bunch of spheres. We actually did 270 samples. And we show that with our interpolated motion graph, we can actually satisfy constraints with 99% success. Whereas we don't use it in interpolation, it's only about 33% success. Another experiment, we placed different placement of columns, and we can synthesize motion of your jumping across all those different columns. And if you don't use interpolation, you can only jump across the columns that whatever you captured in the original motion capture data. Another example of the character going under bars of different heights, and again, the motion patterns look optimal. And this is just the first example that I showed you in the beginning. It just illustrates that we can synthesize long motions with different and variety of behaviors just based on this very simple sketch. Thank you.
Time for a question or two. Might as well spend the time while they're switching on AV.
Does the optimal path fit the normal activity because of which is the optimal path model, or is there?
So it's just, we're just finding emotion which minimizes some square torques, and we think that's what humans usually do. We try to find whatever the most energy efficient patterns when we do, when whenever we do some activity. That's why you find walk and then duck, and if you just find any solution, it can whatever strategy. So minimizing some square torques seem to work to pick up natural human strategies.
So my name is Jernej. This is joint work with my advisor, Doug James. So the problem that we're trying to address in this paper is to simulate contact between objects with detailed geometry, some of which might be also deformable. And the point is to simulate multi-point contact, meaning that there can be several simultaneous contact sites between the two objects. And each of these contact sites can have a non-zero surface area. So why do we want to do this? Because we want to do haptic simulations. So what is haptics? So this is a haptic device. The user is holding the haptic device, and they are controlling that blue ball in the simulation. And as the ball collides with the bridge, appropriate contact forces are computed, and they are actually rendered to the device. So the user can actually feel the forces, the contact forces, as they are touching the bridge. So haptic simulations are difficult because they require very high update rates. So about 1,000 hertz in order to keep the haptic device stable. So in this paper that we just submitted, we present a method to haptically render two detailed objects in contact at haptic rates. So why is this a difficult problem? Well, it's necessary to maintain 1,000 hertz frame rate, which means that within 1 millisecond, during every time step, we have to do collision detection between the two objects, we have to compute the contact forces and torques, and we have to do the finite element method time stepping to simulate the deformable dynamics of any deformable objects in the scene. Okay, so here is a result video showing a bridge versus a dinosaur. So here the user is controlling the green dinosaur. The dinosaur is rigid, the bridge is deformable. You can see in the lower left part of the screen, you can see the microseconds count, which is telling you how many microseconds it takes to finish one haptic cycle. This number should be below 1,000, because 1,000 microseconds would be 1 millisecond. Here the black mesh is actually showing what's imposed with the haptic device. Here I'm pulling on the cables. Okay, another result. Deformable dragon versus a rigid Buddha. So here I'm controlling the brown rigid Buddha. Both objects have very detailed geometry. And you can see that it's able to sustain the haptic rates. So this is now to demonstrate the detail that we can render with this method. So you can see that I can stick the horn and I can you know, feel the folds on the cloth, on the Buddha. So here I'm showing that, you know, I have a really large area of contact. Okay. So how does this work? Okay. So one of the two objects is always represented as a point shell. A point shell is a collection of points positioned near regularly on the surface of the object. Okay. And the other object in the simulation is always a distance field. Okay. Now let's see the point shell first. So this is the point shell for the bridge. It's actually a multi-resolution point shell. And here you can see how the point shell deforms together with the object. Okay, the distance field is a standard data structure in computer graphics. Basically, we feed a bounding box around the rigid dinosaur. And then we have a uniform grid in all three dimensions. And for every point on the grid, we pre-compute the distance from that point to the nearest point on the dinosaur. And if you're outside the dinosaur, we keep a plus sign. And if you're inside, we keep a minus sign. So then this way, at runtime, if you give me an arbitrary position within this distance field box, I can very quickly, through interpolation, I can determine the distance to the nearest point on the dinosaur, and I can determine whether I'm in contact or not. So we put these two together, the potential and the distance field. So the distance field is rigidly transforming together with the Buddha that I'm manipulating. And at every haptic cycle, I have to traverse all the points of the potential. And for every point of the potential, I look the position, the transformed position into the distance field to determine whether that point is in contact or not. And if it is in contact, then I apply proper penalty forces to resolve the contact. Okay, so this works fine, except the problem is that with this approach, you can only simulate very small point shells. So on current hardware, you can simulate something about 5,000 points within 1 millisecond, because it takes time to transform the point into the frame of reference on the distance field and to actually look up into the distance field. Okay. So how can we simulate larger point shells? So in this paper, we simulate point shells that have like 1 million points in the point shell. Well, we organize the point shell into a multi-resolution hierarchy. And then we traverse this hierarchy in a breadth-first order, as indicated by these green arrows. And this gives us two benefits. One benefit is that this can quickly cull away large parts of the point shells. So if some part of the model is far away from contact, an entire subtree will be culled, and I won't have to check the points in that subtree. Another benefit is that I can have graceful degradation of contact, meaning that if the contact simulation contact is so complicated that I cannot finish the traversal, I can simply stop the traversal at some depth in the tree. And this way, I can have a trade-off. So if I have a slower computer, I can compute, the simulation doesn't fail. It still computes some forces. Right? And the better the forces, the deeper you go, and the more accurate the forces. OK, so here is another result. So these kind of simulations are useful for virtual assembly. So here I'm controlling the green mechanical object, and I'm manipulating it in between these deformable hoses. So this kind of a simulation can be used like during design of an airplane. For example, if you're designing an engine, you want to know whether you can pull out a certain part of the engine later on when you have to service the engine. So the idea here is to, during the design, say if I'm an airplane factory, I'm going to run a haptic simulation and check whether I can perform a certain maneuver using haptics. And then if I cannot, you know, I know that I have to change my model, you know, and this way I can avoid the cost of actually having to build these structures in real life. Okay. So another application, well, is path planning. So this is the very well-known alpha puzzle from robotics. So the blue alpha needs to be snapped into the red alpha, and here the blue alpha is linked to the haptic device, and I can do this path planning interactively on the haptic device and can feel the forces and torques as I enter contact. So another possible application is games with haptics. So in this example, the user is controlling the rigid axe, and they're hitting the knight, which is also rigid. And so it's like playing a game, you know, they are, you know, interacting in real time, and they can feel the contact forces and torques as they are impacting the knight. Okay, and finally, we can also do contact between two deformable objects. So in this case, both the dinosaur and the dragon are deformable. So these kind of simulations are very difficult because it's necessary to do collision detection between deformable models. Actually, we need to deform the distance field at interactive rates such that we can look up the potential positions appropriately. So the blue outline showed you the rigid configurations so that you can actually see the deformations. And you can see that it's barely able to sustain 1,000, the frame rate of 1,000 hertz because the contact is very complicated. Okay, so this concludes my presentation. Happy to answer any questions now. It's not symmetric because one is a point shell, the other one is, in this case, a deformable distance field.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The contact model is the same in all cases: rigid, 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 deformable, deformable, deformable. Query the point against the transformed distance field. Okay. Any more questions? We have time.
Yeah.
If there is one.
Questions?
Okay. Thank you. Hi, I'm Adam Bartel, and for the next few minutes I'm going to talk about a finite element method for large viscoplastic flow. This is joint work with Chris Wojtan from Georgia Tech, Jessica Hodgins, and Greg Turk, who's also at Georgia Tech. Viscoplastic materials are things that we encounter in our everyday lives all the time, like toothpaste and chewing gum that'll get stuck to the bottom of your shoe. What these materials all have in common is that they demonstrate both elastic and plastic deformation. That is, they deform elastically like a rubber ball, but sometimes under large stresses you can actually deform them permanently. So you take clay and you shape it into something. That's a plastic deformation. The rest shape of the clay is now changed. And these are the types of materials we're going to try and model. And we're going to use, like the title said, a finite element method, which has been used for elastic solids in computer graphics for some time, and it works quite well for these purposes. But like I said, we're interested in these plastic deformations, and we need to enhance our finite element method to handle these sorts of materials. So here you can see that there's been some permanent deformation, and this isn't going to go back to that rounded tetrahedral shape. So the first step in a finite element method is to create your finite elements. So in two dimensions, we just take our object that we want to mesh, and we create a nice triangle mesh, so nice Delaunay mesh there. The next part is to calculate the forces that are going to return you to your rest shape. So if we look at just a single element, a single deformed element, we can look at its rest shape in its original configuration, and we can calculate forces that will return that element to its rest shape. A fundamental calculation in order to generate these forces is computing the deformation gradient, which is represented by F. And that's, in our finite element method, this is actually just a simple matrix multiply. So X is going to be a matrix that encodes the deformed state or shape, and beta is going to be a matrix that encodes the rest shape. And we multiply them together, and that gives us our deformation gradient. And then we can use the deformation gradient to then compute forces which return the deformed state to the rest state. The thing about plastic deformation is that it actually changes the rest state. And in previous methods, they basically approach this problem by still comparing our deformed state to the original rest state, and then using the new rest state when computing the actual forces. So you got a deformation gradient that was based on the original rest state, but then you use this plastic deformation to try and make sure that the forces didn't try and undo that. We take a different approach and actually forget about the original rest state. We use the new rest state and explicitly update our beta matrix to take into account that this rest state has changed. And we do that by taking our deformation gradient F, we break it up into two parts, the elastic part F sub E and the plastic part F sub P. And then we can calculate a new beta matrix that's just calculated from these two equations on the left. And it only takes into account the elastic part of the deformation. Things can still go wrong though. If we allow a large plastic flow, our rest state may become nearly degenerate. When this happens, the beta matrix can become ill-conditioned, and then the simulation explodes. The answer to this problem is actually to remesh. So this is the second key idea behind our approach. When our state becomes poor, we will then just remesh and create a new state that has all nice elements, and now our beta matrices will all be well-conditioned. We never let our state get really, really bad, because then we're sort of in a bad state and we can't back up. So you can see here that this mesh on the left isn't really all that bad, but it is not perfect, and this is a nice Delaunay mesh, which is a little bit nicer. Here's an example in 2D. Please, ignore the ugly rendering, but you can see what's going on here. When there's lots of deformation, the mesh starts to change, and this was actually demonstrating some work softening, so as the material deforms, it becomes easier to deform plastically. And so in the end, we're not going to return to that shape at all. There's been a lot of plastic flow. Here's a three-dimensional example, and you can see that the surface is still remeshing, but the surface isn't changing much. And we actually went through a lot of effort to make sure the surface wouldn't change much so that we don't get any visual artifacts when you look at the final results. If you were to look at a cross-section of this mesh, there's actually substantial change. So we needed some plasticity model, and I'm just going to talk about a simplified version here. Like I mentioned, we split our F matrix up into the elastic and plastic parts. To compute the plastic part, we look at the magnitude of the stress in any given element. If the magnitude of the stress is less than some threshold, then there's no plastic deformation, and we set Fp to the identity. If the magnitude of the stress is greater than a threshold, though, we're going to set Fp to be proportional to some flow rate mu times how much we've gone past our threshold. So there's two parameters here that have a different effect on the material properties. So here's an animation of a bunny falling down the stairs. And this is another example of work softening. So the ears are softer than the rest of the body and deform more, have more permanent deformation. And here's a bunny being tortured over a bar. So I'd like to just show what the parameter space looks like. So this is just a purely elastic simulation. And now we're going to increase the flow rate so that we'll get more and more plastic flow. So this is how quickly the plastic flow is happening. And you know, the faster it happens, the more you can have. And so you can see that the tetrahedra seem to deform more and more with this plastic deformation. And when the flow rate gets really, really large, it flows completely. And so we maximize it at 1. And so there's not too much difference between the later examples. But we can also vary our yield point while we keep the flow rate constant. And by reducing our yield point, we're again allowing more plastic flow, but it's allowing it in a different way. And so we get different behaviors than we did just by adjusting the flow rate. One of the goals of computer graphics is to try and simulate reality. And so one thing that we did was to use Srinivas's high-speed camera and actually videotape some cooking dough shaped as a star falling on the ground. And then we tried to create a simulation which matched this real footage as well as possible. And it's not a perfect match, but you can see that there are some salient features that are very similar. And that's the end of my talk.
Questions for Adam?
Sorry. Oops. Yeah.
So, did the bunny, did it torn at all? In other words, did it go around and reconnect?
Yes, it did. It didn't tear at all, but the way the mesher works, it actually, if things are close together and a remeshing happens, it'll just join those things because the mesh is lower resolution than the space separating them. To try and actually keep those things separate would be an area of future work. Any other questions?
I'm James, and this is work with Alosha Efros on image completion. So say I have this photograph. Decent photograph, but I don't like the tower crane in the upper right. Kind of throws off the whole European theme. So say I want to erase that out of my image. Then this would be an example of an input to an image completion algorithm. You're giving an image that is somehow incomplete. Maybe part of it was damaged. Maybe you didn't want part of it. Maybe you're trying to extend the borders. Maybe you're trying to build a panorama that's not completely overlapped, but for whatever reason, the algorithm needs to put something there such that, you know, a human can't really tell that there was a manipulation there if they just see this image. So here's another case of the same thing. I didn't really like that construction site, so give it to an algorithm, and so. So brief overview of the algorithm. If for any incomplete image we get, such as this one, we're going to look for similar scenes in a really big database of images, say a million images. And this is showing the 10 nearest neighbor scenes for this one, and you can see that they're all semantically pretty much the same. They're cities with alleyways down the middle. They also kind of have similar geometry, similar vanishing points and horizon. And then we're going to take this set of nearest neighbors, say 60 or 100, I'm not showing them all, and then we're going to do, you know, kind of a search, a more local search, for, try and find a patch that's seamless, and say we end up finding that this image has, you know, the best patch to fill that hole. Then we go through a compositing step to fuse those images together as seamlessly as possible. And then there's the output. So let's compare to previous work. Again, I'm removing a car in this case. So all previous image completion algorithms work by taking patches from the input image, from this incomplete image, and just rearranging them somehow, either doing it in lots of little blocks or one giant block, but you know, the fundamental restriction is that they're only reusing texture that's already in that image, and of course they don't really have any semantic knowledge of what's going on. They're just trying to follow some low-level heuristics like let's continue straight lines, and they generally don't work. Whereas our method, you know, will search for a matching scene, and upon finding a matching scene, you know, it turns out, hey, there should probably be a street there between those buildings, and that's what we get. It's just not perfect. The lane markings don't really make any sense, but better. So why hasn't somebody done this before? It seems obvious to fill holes in images by looking in other images. Well, it turns out that you need a lot of data to make it work. Our algorithm didn't really work with 10,000 images. It wasn't until we got to a million that it started to kind of work, and kind of work is the state where we are. And to get all of these images and process them and search them, it takes a lot of computational power, and we had a cluster that we could use, so it wasn't too much of a problem. So even if you have enough data, enough images, it's difficult to find the best, you know, semantic matches for any input image. You know, you can't just take random patches, and you can't just take patches that match some low-level qualities. You need to, you know, take a patch from some scene in the database such that when you fill a hole, it's going to, you know, make semantic sense. And that's really the hardest part of this. And finally, since we're working with different images, it's just harder than it was in previous work to make sure that things are seamless, because it's more likely that the colors don't match and so on. So we collected data off of Flickr. We just downloaded 30 groups. And you can see that it's generally very high quality images, high resolution. Outdoor images mostly. So we got 1.5 million images total, and quite a few of those ended up being too small, and quite a few ended up being duplicates, you know, submitted to multiple groups, so we just threw those away and ended up a little short of a million. And So the real hard part is, like I said, making sure that the completions are semantically valid. So let's say, take this example where I don't really like the sky because it's overexposed and boring, and I'd like to put something more interesting there. So we query our database, and that's not very good. You know, this happened to match the colors really well or something, but obviously when you fuse these images together, it's not going to make any sense. Here's another example. This is MIT's Stata Center, and again, not a very good scene match. So we have to be a little smarter about this. We used a scene matching algorithm from Antonio Tarabla and Ode Olivia, and basically, I won't go into the mechanics very far than to say that it's a bunch of oriented edge responses at multiple scales, but you can see these are 8 clusters that came out of their smaller data set. So like this is a cluster of tall buildings, and there's a cluster of kind of roadways, and they tend, you know, they're semantically similar and they're structurally similar, and this is perfect. These are the type of matches that we want, so this is what we use. And these are some of the results. You already saw this bottom one, but again, there's kind of a rural lake scene, and you can see the top 10 nearest neighbors in our database. So that's a lot of very useful data. We're in good shape. And the final step is just, you know, compositing, and I won't go into detail other than to say that we did some graph cut and Poisson blending. So again, I'm just going to go through a lot of results now. So this was an original image. Again, this is the input to the algorithm. This is all the algorithm sees. And then I'll show one of the outputs. And the input will be there in case you want to look back at that. So this is Frick Park. Maybe I don't really like the fence there. So this one kind of cut out a little more than you might have wanted. The graph cut has kind of that freedom to look for seamless boundaries by removing more of the source image. This is Pittsburgh, but if we cut out the Pittsburgh part, then we get a nicer picture. And this is a very contrived example. I'm just creating a test case where existing algorithms don't have a chance because they now don't have any texture that shows ground sky interface. But our algorithm can still go, you know, find a hillside from somewhere else. And there's some blending artifacts here that kind of cut into the building. Can remove the out-of-focus area to kind of extend depth of field, make a nicer picture. This one is just kind of a toy example. This one changed the semantics maybe more than you would want. Here I don't like the netting on the cathedral. It's under renovation, so I can erase that. And in this case, it happened to find another picture of the same cathedral, so that is actually what's under there. Can get rid of this advertising console. And it's not perfect, again. You can see that it left behind some feet without a person attached to them. What to remove? So, one more thing. The algorithm gives a user like lots of potential outputs, really, say 15. It tries multiple images and takes segments from multiple images and just shows them all to the user. And a lot of times, there are several good ones in there. So you already saw outputs for these images, and these are two more outputs that are kind of decent. A lot of times, the other outputs are garbage, to be honest. And so that little user interaction is pretty helpful to us. But it's something that other image completion algorithms can't really offer. So we're selling that as a positive thing. All right, that's it. Any questions?
So right now you just use human judgment to select among the alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no, to pick the alternatives, there's no heuristics that you use to evaluate which ones are better than others?
Well, I mean, there are. They come back with a ranking, but it's not terribly meaningful because we didn't focus on that. I mean, you can look at the scene matching score, the template matching score, how much the seam cost, seam, not scene. And you can, you know, add those together and try and get an idea of it. If we really wanted to restrict ourselves to only returning one output. But we don't do that now.
So if you had some method of estimating the likelihood of any particular image, that might help pick which ones are most possible.
Yeah, that's true. We could, Galosha suggested we could take the output and then look up in the database again for matches. It's kind of like a sanity check that this scene could exist. Conceivably, we should be creating, you know, possible scenes. But yeah, any sort of likelihood function would work.
All right. I'm Chris Twigg. I'll be presenting some work that I did with my advisor, Doug James, who's at Cornell. It's on the New Worlds browser. So simulation is an accepted part of modern film production. So we use simulation for things like water or cloth or fire or rigid bodies bouncing around. However, simulation has one major drawback, and that is that when we use simulation in a movie, generally the director starts out with some idea of what he wants to see in the final scene, such as this anonymous director here might have something like this in mind. The character flips around a couple times, lands on the chair. But when you actually go and set up this scene and run your simulator, you end up with something much more boring where the character just falls down. And so what tends to happen in these cases is if the director wants something very specific, then it ends up getting hand animated. And this is a very tedious process, especially because getting the physics to actually look like physics is hard to do for people. So we could imagine setting this up as kind of an optimization problem, where the first term of the optimization problem captures these kind of user constraints that correspond to what the director has in his head. And the second term of the optimization captures this kind of physical correctness, which basically says we're going to allow the physical correctness of the simulation to relax just a little bit so that we can allow our optimization algorithm to have some kind of control over the resulting simulation. We minimize this function, and we end up with some animation that has, you know, approximates the director's constraints and also gets the physics roughly correct. However, optimization has major drawbacks when used in kind of feature film production. And I'll describe briefly the optimization pipeline now. So you start out by setting up, you know, here's the user constraints. They have to be specified in some way. Maybe they're a keyframe at time zero, a keyframe at time one, and so forth. And then you wait, And you wait, and you wait a little while longer, and maybe you wait minutes, maybe you wait hours, or maybe you wait days for a result to come back. And if you're lucky, it comes back with some result that hopefully captures exactly what you asked for. If you're not so lucky, though, you end up coming back with no solution at all. And for simulations that involve even a moderate number of rigid bodies, this is going to be the case more often than not, just because for rigid body simulations with collisions, you have a very discontinuous space, it's highly nonlinear, and a lot of optimization algorithms don't work very well in those kinds of spaces. On the other hand, simulating rigid bodies is really easy and incredibly fast. So this is a demo that NVIDIA and Havok have been showing off, which shows this real-time GPU physics engine that Havok and NVIDIA have been put together. And you can see that you have hundreds of rigid bodies and they're all interacting in real time. Furthermore, we'd like to hypothesize that our director here has a lot more intelligence, is a lot more adaptable than any optimization algorithm we could possibly throw at this problem. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to provide the director with some useful but simple tools that he can go in and he can just kind of explore the space of options and direct the optimization in directions that he wants to get. And hopefully we'll get very good results out of this. So here's a sort of basic outline of our approach. So we start out, the director sets up the scene, sets up all the rigid bodies in the scene, and the initial conditions of them, and sends it out to our cluster of machines or our GPU-based simulation engine. And that's going to compute a large number of simulation examples. Each one of these is going to be some slight variation, maybe varying the initial conditions, maybe perturbing the simulation along the way. And it'll send them back to the director's computer. And so the user gets to look at all these different examples. Here we're visualizing them using these various paths for the, each simulation is representing, each one of these paths is representing the path of one of these bodies for a particular simulation. And the user gets to go through, explore the space. We provide some tools for the user to explore the space. Once the user picks a simulation that he likes, but maybe it's not perfect, the user can go and say, I like this simulation, but I don't like these objects at this time. And we'll have these refinement operators, which basically the simulation gets sent back to the cluster and it computes more examples with the rest of the simulation kept the same except for those objects that he wants refined. So this is a lot easier to show you than it is to describe. So here's a simple example. And here we have this little trebuchet model that's going to be throwing this ball at this castle. And as you can see, the initial position of the trebuchet is randomized, and in our interface, you can randomize any property very easily. And this is just visualizing the path of the trebuchet. Now we're visualizing the path of the ball, and we're showing some user interface tools that the user can use to select among the examples. So here we selected the path of the ball. He's drawing these little green screen space constraints that just say, I want the ball to pass through this and hit this part of the turret. Or here we're seeing the ball, the bricks from the tower, we want them to fall down and land on these characters. We can also apply so there's lots of different examples. We can also apply negative constraints, so we can select the same group of objects and draw these red constraints that basically say, I don't want the path of this object to actually pass through this region. So we'd like to protect these characters. And then we can find examples that come close to hitting the characters but don't quite hit them. All right, here's another example. We're going to show you an example of the refinement. So you'll see this clock in the upper right-hand corner. That's actually the real-time clock for the user interaction. This had to be sped up in order to fit within the SIGGRAPH video. So we'd like these letters to fall down. It's this little pachinko machine model, and we'd like them to spell out SIGGRAPH, and they'd like them all to land right set up as well. So the first step is the user turns on sampling and starts getting examples of possible paths, right? And now the user is drawing a bunch of constraints to say, I want the S to land here, the I to land here, and so on and so forth. And we can see that the most constraints that the user can satisfy at the current time is 3. So now the user is going to need to refine. So the I is clearly not landing in the right place, right? We need it to land farther over so they can actually spill out SIGGRAPH. So we start refining the I. And if we pick this path, it actually gets fairly close. We're going to need it to land more here, but we can refine from around here in order to get that to. Now the user's got most of the letters in place, but the orientations aren't right. So we can just do a little refinement on the end of the path to kind of try to get that lined up. And we can sort by orientation in order to get the most upright versions of these. So here he's using a constraint just to make sure that the letters don't get inverted. We don't want to mess up our spelling. Here's the final rendered result. All right, now here's an example, maybe a little more violent. So we're going to throw this character down the staircase. We'd like it, it's a spiral staircase. It's got three levels of spiral staircase, and we'd like the character to get all the way down to the bottom. So again, the user goes ahead, turns on sampling, eventually. Oh, I guess it's already on. And we start looking at these paths. Now you can see that if you just do naive sampling, there's no way the user's going to make it all the way down this very long staircase, right? We can find examples where you kind of turns the first corner correctly, right? And we can start refining those, because those are the kind of the most likely candidates to get them a little bit further down. And we can kind of keep doing this in an iterative process. And it actually happens surprisingly quickly. So here's your real-time clock again. Here's an example where the user, having the user in the loop is useful, because the user can quickly say, oh, this is not the kind of motion I want. I don't want him to fall the entire way down his butt. Here's the render result. Now in graphics, we like to get as close to reality as possible, so we took Srinivas's high-speed camera and just kidding. All right, another thing that we can do with our refinement operator is there's absolutely nothing about the refinement operator that requires that the objects in the scene be exactly the same ones that we started with. So we can actually add objects to the scene as we're going through this process, and that's going to be a useful tool to the artists, because they can just go ahead and say, oh wait, I'd really like to see more shrapnel here, and add a little more in. So this is a simple refrigerator magnet toy that you may have seen mocked up here. So the first thing we'll notice when the user selects the ball is that all these paths are kind of hitting it on the side, and that's not really right. So we can quickly just grab this object, move it over a little bit, so that it can get into the path of the ball that's falling down. And it gets marked in red to show that it's not synced up with the current set of examples. But the user can quickly just say, fix that. Now it's actually landing in the chute, or in the, I don't know what you call that thing. Now we're going to duplicate it. We just drop it down so it's kind of in the path of the ball. Now we can look for, say the user really wants the thing to rotate the other way to get sort of an interesting effect. That's kind of a minority position, but you can still get it. We'll duplicate it a few more times, add a couple shoots. And here's our end result. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Questions for Chris?
Yeah.
What is the nature of the perturbations for that simulation?
So we actually just, we have this sort of feature detection that just looks for collisions. And then every time we see a collision, there's some instantaneous change in velocity. And we can just perturb that change in velocity by a little bit. So that's all. It's proportional to the change of velocity and in roughly the same direction. What's commonly done is perturbing the normals, which is kind of what we're getting at, but we tweaked it a little bit just to... Yeah?
What's the next step?
Next step. So we've added sound.
Controllable sound, or just, are you doing the same thing with sound that you do with motion?
It's just adding sound to the rigid body, so you can the idea is to be able to sort of make it play out some tune or something like that. We've talked about fluids, potentially. That's a tougher problem because it's a lot more data.
That's a much longer computation.
Right.
Okay, well, why don't we thank all six speakers? Great work.